Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, who is dead in the water right now, he'll be joining us momentarily on Zoom, but joining us as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger, by now well known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights. Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of arenas. 6 to 8 months ago, we heard a lot about a changing landscape in the United States Supreme Court. Your Legal Rights looked at the court, considered whether the Supreme Court would ultimately decide the outcome of the presidential election, if any major game-changing cases were on the docket, and pondered how a newly reconstituted court might decide some of these pending cases. Tonight we pick up from there. Now that the term is at its end, the last opinions are to be handed down tomorrow, we stop to look at some of these recent decisions and ponder what was considered and just what the court did. How did a new court with Justice Barrett differ from the court as it looked at the start of the term?
Our returning guests tonight are esteemed appellate lawyers engaged in the legal landscape of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. Who better to look in the rearview mirror at the past year's decisions than perhaps look down the barrel of the Supreme Court to see what's likely to come up next?
As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. That is if you're in the Bay Area. If you're not in the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, we'll pay for the call if you call us at 866-798-8255. And as always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice as we don't have all the salient facts of your case. We're happy to share legal principles with you to help guide you in your decision-making. And you can contact us with any question about the Supreme Court, newly decided or upcoming cases there. You could even talk to us about appellate litigation in general. You're not limited to the point where we may be in our conversation.
To help us sort out what's going on out there, we first have Ben Feuer, who is the chairman of the California Appellate Law Group, a boutique law firm specializing in appeals with offices in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. Ben has been called one of the top appellate litigators in California by a national news network and named one of the top 40 appellate lawyers in California under 40 by the Daily Journal. Actually, I think that's one of the top lawyers, not just appellate lawyers, under 40. Among other honors, he clerked on the Ninth Circuit, and he frequently writes on constitutional and appellate matters for publications like the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the National Law Journal.
Also joining us tonight, a partner at King & Spalding in the firm's Appellate, Constitutional, and Administrative Law Group, and Voight has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, and federal and state appellate and trial courts, and argued nearly 60 cases in federal and state appellate courts. She previously served as a Supreme Court clerk, a Ninth Circuit clerk, and as a federal prosecutor with over a decade of public service. Ms. Voight is certified as a specialist in appellate law by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. And to one and all, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks. We're delighted to be here.
Even if we made you sweat for the first few seconds.
Exactly.
So it looks like there's a few interesting cases that came down over the last couple months, and I wanted to give you a chance to kind of freewheel and go through some of them with us. But just as a general rule, it looked like there was a whole lot less surprises than perhaps the media would have had us expect. It looks like the world is still turning and nothing's really changed that much. Am I right in that perception?
Yeah, I mean, this was a wild term in some ways, at least based on kind of what people thought might be coming. This term really began with the nomination and confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg not all that long ago, less than a year ago. It's really pretty amazing to kind of think about how far we've come in that one short year. One of the big questions I think people were wondering was, you know, will this be a term where the Supreme Court is going to decide the presidential election? Is this a term where a newly emboldened, radically conservative majority, more than just a 5-4 majority, a 6-3 majority, was going to dramatically upend the expectations and understandings of what American law is like? And really, none of those things came to pass. It was a fascinating term in all of those respects, I think, as much for what the court did not choose to do as what the court did choose to do. Of course, this is just the first year of this 6-3 majority for the conservatives on the Supreme Court. So and during this program, we're going to try to talk a little bit about some of the cases that are coming up next term as well. But, it's been a very interesting time for those of us who watch the Supreme Court. And, we're going to talk about some of the cases that have been decided.
Yeah. And I would add just to what Ben said, two things that were interesting. One is that while there is a 6-3 conservative majority, what's been interesting is that conservative majority is certainly not a monolith. And you'll see as we talk through some of the cases that there are some breakdowns between them in how they approach certain issues and certain topics. So I think anyone who thought that there was going to be a consistent 6-3 lineup turned out to be wrong so far. I also think it's an interesting term just from the standpoint of how COVID affected everything. You had arguments that for the first time were being broadcast live. And so you could actually listen in real time to arguments going on in the Supreme Court, which, federal appellate courts have been doing that for a while, but the Supreme Court has always held off. And because they were making accommodations so that each justice had a certain turn, we heard more probably from Justice Thomas this term than we heard from him in any oral argument all put together for the rest of his tenure on the court.
And, the COVID cases, which there were a few COVID cases, I mean, since we've sort of started talking about the effect of COVID, were one of the examples where you really did see, even though the Supreme Court perhaps didn't shift as far to the right as some commentators expected at the beginning of the term, where you really did see a big difference between what the court was like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was on the court, and it was a 5-4 conservative majority with John Roberts kind of as the swing vote. And now when Ruth Bader Ginsburg is no longer on the court, Justice Barrett is on the court, and John Roberts is no longer in the kind of swing vote position. Many folks think Justice Brett Kavanaugh, also a relatively controversial recent Trump appointee, is now kind of the center swing justice on the court. So, the COVID cases are a really good example of kind of what's going on in the court's dynamic. When at the beginning of the term, when Justice Ginsburg was still alive, there were a number of challenges to state laws that shut down or limited the ability of churches to hold services out of the state government's determinations about the risks due to COVID. Once Justice Barrett came on the court and the pandemic kind of continued on and on, you started seeing the Supreme Court issue decisions that rejected some of those state determinations about when churches should be limited in their attendance or otherwise shut down. In some of the cases, the court seemed to be saying, look, you have to treat churches the same way that you treat other businesses. You can't say grocery stores can be open, but churches can't be open. And in some cases, the court seemed to be suggesting that they thought, maybe churches needed to be treated even more deferentially exponentially than other types of businesses. One of the big shifts that we'll talk about that is very clear from the change in makeup of the court is the level to which this court feels strongly about the importance of religion and importance of kind of religious liberties and the liberties of churches and other religious organizations to kind of present their viewpoints and live their viewpoints, act in a way that protects their particular religious viewpoints. But I think the first case that we thought that we should talk about is one that pretty much all of your listeners, Jeff and Josh, probably are well familiar with. And this is one of the challenges, now the third challenge in the Supreme Court to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. These challenges have been going on basically since the law was passed in 2010. And the reason that these keep coming up in court is because Republicans can't get the 60 votes they need to eliminate the law the way laws should generally be eliminated, which is by statute. And this is also the third time a challenge has failed. I actually think this may be the last time the Supreme Court considers the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, in part because the law at this point has been around for more than 10 years and is very successful. It's a popular law. Some people would say it's been vital in the age of COVID. It's also a very successful political issue for Democrats. In fact, their whole opposition to Amy Coney Barrett when she was being nominated right before the election was really claiming that the Republicans were rushing to put her on the court in order to strike down the Affordable Care Act. Democrats were wrong about that. The Republicans were rushing to put her on the court because they thought she might be in a position to decide the 2020 election in their favor. But in reality, it turned out she didn't do that either. Both Democrats and Republicans were wrong. She neither ruled for Republicans in their lawsuits on the election, nor did she rule for them in their lawsuits against the Affordable Care Act.
I was going to say, before we move on or do anything else, there's two things that this brings up, and I wanted to give you each a chance to chat about it. One of them is, I don't know if our listeners would necessarily be familiar with this, but it's kind of an unusual posture in that they weren't suing the government of the U.S. They weren't suing the Affordable Care Act. This is one state suing another in order to try to posture a way to shut this act down, and unsuccessfully, I might add. But the other thing I wanted you to comment on a little, and then I'll step out of the way, is something we talked about before going on the air. And that is sometimes a judicial conservative isn't the same thing as a conservative in terms of policy. And why that is and how it might take us to different results than we would predict.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right on both counts. I mean, I think that was something that is a theme, not just this term, and I'm sure Anne agrees with me, that not just this term, but, you know, really you can see it going back since the around when the sort of modern political polarization began, and you're certainly going to see it going forward, is that what it means to be a judicial conservative is often totally different than what it means to be a political conservative. The judicial conservative movement is focused on following the text of statutes and laws, deferring in many large ways, not always, but many ways, to what the legislature does and not kind of overriding the legislature by judicial decree. And that's totally different, of course, from what conservative politicians want, which is certain very specific outcomes on issues that are important to them. This worked against Donald Trump dramatically. Donald Trump did not understand any of this. He has very little time for judges. He thinks that, you know, he appoints judges, they owe him a favor, or they're Republican appointees, they're going to rule in his favor because he's a Republican. And you saw his election suits especially shot down. You know, every single one of the 60 suits that were filed, I think, on his behalf was shot down, including those to the Supreme Court. He tweeted about that angrily
all the time when he still had access to Twitter. They took away his toys, you may recall. This is absolutely the case and something that you see in a lot of areas of law where conservatives on the courts will rule in ways that seem to lead to outcomes that are what liberals want. Not always, obviously, in fact, not often, but certainly sometimes. And this is one of those cases where, you're absolutely right. You mentioned the unusual posture of this case. It was brought by Texas. Texas sued California. Each of those states had a number of other states kind of joining with them. And the Supreme Court, that ultimately ended up being kind of the death knell for the lawsuit, because the way the Supreme Court decided this case, 7-2, so much, much more than kind of just the liberals, on board or just one conservative appointee, 7-2, the court said, look, you have to show, if you're going to bring a lawsuit, you have to show that you're injured. And you, Texas, can't show that you were injured by your citizens getting access to insurance. You didn't have to do anything that, bad. You weren't harmed in any way. You're just kind of doing this. They didn't say this, but they hinted, you're doing this for the political points, right? You're doing this because you, governor of Texas, want to be president eventually, and you want to be able, or the solicitor general of Texas, whoever, you want to be able to say that, hey, I hate Obamacare too. And we know that. We get that. So they threw the case out on what they call the doctrine of standing. You, Texas, didn't have the ability to come to court to complain about your own citizens getting insurance. And that's really how the case resolved. And the way the court kind of resolved the case, they made it really hard for anyone else to kind of come in and say, look, we don't think that this law is constitutional at this point. So that's why I think probably the end of the litigation over Obamacare.
And I would agree with Ben. I mean, I think it's interesting. We'll get to two criminal cases where I think you'll see results that, where conservatives sided with criminal defendants in a way that one might not have otherwise anticipated because of a general concern about either governmental overreach in one case, and in another case with a real concern for the sanctity of the home when it comes to Fourth Amendment issues.
We'll get there a little later on in the program, but I am, as a criminal defense attorney, that's something I've been watching for a long time. And it seems that while there isn't much left of the Fourth Amendment in a lot of arenas, our best friends tend to be conservative judges and justices who read it in its plain language and say, this doesn't mean when it's convenient. It doesn't mean when we don't really need that information. It's pretty direct.
Well, I think what you're saying really gets to kind of the heart of the different kinds of conservatives that are out there, because there are some conservatives, again, in the legal, conservatives or legal conservative positions that favor kind of the government. And especially when it comes to criminal law, you commit a crime or you do something wrong, we're going to find a way to make sure you go to jail because that's where you belong. And other kind of legal conservatives who are very skeptical of government authority. And that extends not just to kind of regulations about, the environment, for example, but also to criminal law and what the government is doing in criminal law. So you really get that divide. And you can see that in whenever we talk about the criminal case, you can see that in the Supreme Court, where there are some Supreme Court justices who say, lock them up and throw away the key. And some Supreme Court justices who say, hey, wait a minute, have all of the procedural safeguards been met? Are we kind of defending the individual against the overreach of the government in the way that we think should be?
Well, we've been talking about some of the issues that have divided people. Maybe we can talk about one of the cases where we had a pretty much unanimous lineup, which is a case of Illinois School District versus BL. Let's start, before we talk about what the Supreme Court actually decided, let's talk about the important question they didn't answer, which is what kind of friends take their friend's Snapchat story and then share it with everybody else? That's the real question here. But the question that the Supreme Court did have to decide was the school decision to suspend a cheerleader named Brandy Levy from the cheerleading team for a year based on posts she made to Snapchat outside of school hours and off campus, did that violate the First Amendment? And they concluded that it did. Brandi Levy hadn't made the varsity cheerleading squad, and she posted on her Snapchat story about it, expressing some frustration. And somebody took pictures of it, shared it with teachers and other coaches and other members of the squad, and the school suspended her. And the Supreme Court said, look, you can't do that. Public schools may have a special interest in regulating some off-campus student speech. They weren't willing to create a sort of clear line of on-campus versus off, but the special interests that the school offered here just weren't good enough. And this turned in part on a case called Tinker versus Des Moines, which said, look, there are real reasons for schools to have a special interest in regulating on-campus speech if it materially disrupts work or if it involves substantial disorder or invasion of the rights of others. But they said the First Amendment doesn't entirely vanish either when you're on campus, and it particularly doesn't when you're off. And they said, look, when we're thinking about off-campus speech, there's sort of three things that distinguish it from what happens on. First, when you have students on campus, you think about the school kind of stepping into the shoes of parents. And that's rarely true, the court said, when you've got action that takes place off campus. And they said, look, if schools can also regulate what happens off campus as well as on, you're talking about basically 24 hours a day regulation of student speech. And that would seem to warrant, you know, particular scrutiny under the First Amendment. And then third, they said, look, there's an interest that schools have, whether they agree with it or not, in protecting unpopular speech, including the speech of somebody who's frustrated because they didn't make the varsity team as opposed to junior varsity. They said public schools are supposed to be the incubators of democracy, and that means that sometimes you have to hear speech that you don't like or that seems unpleasant. And they said here, the stuff that she said is entitled to First Amendment protection. The circumstances, you know, in this case, they sort of diminished the school's interest in regulation. It's outside of school. It was to a private circle of Snapchat friends. She didn't identify the school. She didn't target particular classmates. And the schools had said, well, look, we have an interest in teaching good manners. And they said, come on now. You know, this is outside of school on her own time. You know, everybody's got to be able to blow off steam at some point and have that be protected. And then they said, look, you know, and the disruption that the school claimed was that they had to spend 5 to 10 minutes in an algebra class calming people down and that a couple of cheerleaders were upset. That is not what we mean when we're talking about substantial disruption, you know, particularly for off campus. And they said there was no evidence of any sort of substantial interference, even with the school cheerleading team.
You know, and this is, I think, one of the, you know, one of the interesting kinds of cases that is very specific to the internet age. You may recall not that long ago, what, about 10, 15 years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case involving a young student. There was a parade outside of his school, and he held up a sign that said, "Bong hits for Jesus." Whatever that means, and the Supreme Court that kid, you know, he was punished for that, for holding up that sign, and in that case, the Supreme Court said, you know, that's okay for the school to punish that guy. Here we had an event. It was right outside of the school. It was related to school activities. It got a lot of kids on, you know, to get really hyped up who saw that and thought it was really funny. And, you know, we're going to allow the school to punish that guy. This situation, this was on a weekend. She was at home. She was on Snapchat, you know, because the ability in the age of social media, especially the ability to kind of communicate with one's peers and colleagues is now all the time. The court is having to kind of negotiate a pathway whereby it can give some leeway to schools when they really do need to punish speech. For example, you have electronic bullying and, you know, online bullying from one student to another. It seems very clear that the court would be comfortable with the schools punishing that kind of behavior, perhaps very severely. But you also have just generally talking to your pals outside of school, which you certainly could do under this, you know, cheerleader case on your own time. So navigating the pathways and figuring out how previous understandings of the First Amendment apply in the internet age is kind of part of what the court is dealing with as things go forward. And, you know, we're getting young, you know, one of the upsides to having justices like Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett is they're younger folks than somebody who, you know, like Stephen Breyer, who I believe is maybe now in his 80s or late 70s, and you know, may not have as much kind of innate familiarity with the regular, you know, use of the internet. He probably does now, but you know, they're just more familiar with kind of how the internet works, and that may inform what the court does.
In fact, there's a rumor that Justice Kagan has a secret Twitter account that she uses to follow various things. So anybody can figure that out, get some major points. But then just go back to one point you said. I mean, that's what's interesting about this decision, I think, is they leave a lot of things open, right? They aren't willing to draw a clear line between on campus and off, in part because of what you just talked about, the fact that we live in the world of the internet and Zoom classes. And so they specifically carved out exceptions and said, look, we're not talking about something like threats or severe bullying or online classes. That isn't what's at stake here. What we're talking about is somebody who thought she was talking to her friends, or as Justice Alito put it in air quotes in his concurrence, her friends.
Yeah, frenemies.
And blowing off steam. And that's very different than the sort of thing where you really think that a school might be warranted in regulating off-campus speech.
So what other cases do we have that have come up that seem to be closely related? I note there's one involving the NCAA that just came out in the last couple of days.
Yeah, absolutely. This was, talking about unanimity, this was a 9-0 decision authored by Justice Gorsuch. There was a concurring opinion from Justice Kavanaugh. And this dealt with how the antitrust laws apply to student athletes and the NCAA's prohibitions, in this case, on educational benefits. And the antitrust law basically, make it easy, under the antitrust laws, you can't collude with other employers, you know, and agree, okay, we're not going to pay anybody X. That's one of the things that you can't do. And so here the question was, you had some D1 football and basketball athletes, and this began 7 years ago when they filed a class action saying, look, under the NCAA rules, universities can provide scholarships that cover tuition and basic expenses, but they can't either pay athletes. And there were limits on other educational benefits, things like paid postgraduate internships or paying for your grad school they couldn't do.
Or the computer you need to study.
Exactly, right? So they could cover books and room and board, but they couldn't cover like your laptop. And so the district court had granted an injunction that essentially said, look, the NCAA can't have these prohibitions on education-related benefits, but it's okay for them to have prohibitions on direct compensation or on student-athletes getting endorsement deals. The only issue in front of the Supreme Court was the education-related benefits. And they said, look, under the antitrust laws, the NCAA isn't allowed to do this. They can't have this categorical prohibition. And interestingly, I think Justice Kavanaugh wrote in his concurrence that he actually thought that this laid open the question about whether those prohibitions on direct compensation and on endorsement deals for student-athletes could actually stand in the wake of this.
You know, we've been hearing a lot about antitrust laws lately, particularly as they apply to tech companies. And that's been a lot, you know, in the news. Both parties kind of have issues with the size and power of tech companies and have been kind of throwing the antitrust laws around. But where it's come up to the court is in, you know, college sports. And a lot of people care about college sports. Maybe even more people care about college sports than care about the tech companies, especially in Washington, D.C., which is a very sports-focused town. So, you know, this to me is kind of the first stage of the end of the NCAA's ability to say, look, you know, the reason people watch the NCAA is because our athletes are amateurs, and everyone likes that they're amateurs and they're not being paid. And so they don't have these big egos and these big paychecks. I think people, you know, for the most part, the Supreme Court, Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence especially, made very clear that everyone knows this is kind of baloney, that, you know, the NCAA makes a huge amount of money from these athletes. The colleges and universities make huge amounts of money from these athletes. And the reason we know they make all this money is because the coaches' pay has gone up dramatically. If what people really cared about was the amateur nature of the sport, why are college coaches making tens of millions of dollars or more? So, you know, I think this is, you know, pretty soon you're going to see an end to kind of the amateur status of college athletes in the NCAA, and they're going to start getting paid for their hard work.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Your hosts tonight are Jeff Hayden and Josh Borger. We're joined tonight by appellate lawyers extraordinaire Ben Fuhr and Ann Voights. Tonight, we're taking a look at the Supreme Court term that ends tomorrow. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free. We'll pay the freight if you call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about appellate litigation? You want to talk about the Supreme Court? You want to talk about how they have just outlawed life on the planet Earth? Call us. You don't have to join us in the exact spot we are in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Janixa Bravo was scrolling on Twitter when she found a thread of tweets about sex work. It was a roller coaster of emotions. It was funny, it was dark, it was real. And that's when she knew she had to turn this Twitter thread into a movie. You'll hear all about Janixa Bravo's new film, Zola. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC for the 7 o'clock hour this evening on member-supported 91.7 FM and online at KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we've noticed that there seems to be a common thread amongst these cases. It looks like our athletes are now free to perhaps do some make some money on the side or have their educational benefits undaunted. What things have come down that might affect theirs or others' ability to practice their religion?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think there are a couple of cases that came up this term involving religious liberties. And you know, when Justice Coney Barrett was put on the court, I think a lot of people started really focusing on religion and what the court was going to do with the religious element of the First Amendment. There's also a focus on the Second Amendment, guns, not as much this term, maybe next term, but religion is really important. The court's makeup on religion is and has been for many years fascinating. In a country that is about 70% Protestant, the Supreme Court is made up entirely of Catholics and Jews. And in fact, the three liberals on the court are Jewish, and the six Catholics on the court are conservative. Maybe Justice Sotomayor is a Catholic as well. So you've got one liberal Catholic, and then you know two liberal Jewish justices, and then everyone else is a Catholic. So that's a fascinating breakdown, and historians will spend a lot of time kind of thinking about kind of why that may be. But one thing that we have seen is a steady progression of folks who are more and more religious. Justice Barrett coming on the court is an extremely religious Catholic. She was involved with a strict and secretive organization called People of Praise at one point, in fact, living in the founder's home at one point. And there was this expectation that is turning out to be true that she's going to be especially sympathetic towards religion. So we talked about kind of the COVID cases a little bit earlier. The first big test of the religion, other religious issues other than the pandemic, came up in a case this term called Fulton against City of Philadelphia. And what makes this case also somewhat interesting is it also involves the rights of gays and lesbians. And so in this is a case involving foster care. Philadelphia has a foster care system that works where the city works with private foster care agencies. They contract with something more than 20 private organizations that place children in need of foster care with different foster parents. One of these organizations is a Catholic-affiliated organization, and it opposes, as part of its religious views, homosexuality and same-sex marriage. In 2018, the Philadelphia City Council ordered the city to stop contracting with any organizations in any area that have a discriminatory practice, whether or not that discrimination is part of their religion. And as a result, the city terminated its contract with this Catholic foster care agency. It did that even though the issue had never come up. There had never been a same-sex couple that had sought through this organization to be foster parents. And if they had, the organization kind of just had this policy that it would simply refer them to one of the other two dozen or so organizations that place foster kids in the city. So the organization sued. They said, hey, you're discriminating against us on the basis of our religion. You're canceling this contract simply because we're trying to run our charitable organization in accordance with our genuinely held religious beliefs that teach against that homosexuality and same-sex parenting is wrong. The city said, no, we're not discriminating against you. This is just a neutral regulation that applies to all organizations that contract with the city. None of them can be discriminatory. We don't care what your religion is. You can run your organization privately if you want. You don't have to contract with the city. The lower courts agreed with the city, and they said, look, under existing Supreme Court precedent, a neutral regulation that applies to everyone doesn't violate anyone's religious liberty. Went up to the Supreme Court, and the court took – well, a middle road, you could say, but basically it found in favor of the Catholic group. It reversed. It said that in a pretty straightforward 10-page opinion, unanimous, it said, look, Philadelphia, you've got to respect a group that has a genuinely held religious belief if it's really genuine and really held that way. And you have this ability to create exemptions to your policy against contracting with groups that discriminate. And you really should have given this group an exemption. And, you know, no parent or child would be denied placement with a foster family as a result. And so, you know, you really created this issue when you didn't have to. Three of the more conservative justices, the most conservative justices, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, issued an 80-page opinion that's separately that said, yes, we agree with the result. The city should have created an exemption for this group, but we should go the court should go further, and it should really carve out a big exception for religious organizations that, you know, have to deal with some of these same-sex rights issues. In fact, Justice Alito said that really what this is about is the Philadelphia officials have a problem with groups that believe in the quote-unquote old way of marriage. That didn't get a lot of traction on the court. Most notably, Justice Barrett did not join that opinion. Neither did Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Roberts. All three of them are Catholics. So what does this mean in the future? We'll have to see. It seems the court is really not disposed to forcing private organizations that are religiously affiliated to violate their genuinely held beliefs about same-sex marriages and relationships. But it's also not prepared to upend the general application of most non-discrimination laws that apply, especially to less controversial issues. Because you could imagine a religious group coming up next and saying, look, we need to discriminate on the basis of race because we don't believe in interracial marriages and their ability to raise children, or that our religion says something about, you know, women have to be in a subservient role in their marriages, and if we're not going to place a kid with a couple unless the woman states that she's going to be in a subservient role to the man. And so the court really wasn't ready to go so far and to carve out this kind of big exception, but there are some members of the court who might. That I think is a really interesting religious case for this court, because people really didn't know what to expect with some new, very religious folks on the Supreme Court. There was another religious liberty case. There were two real big religious liberty cases this term. And this other religious liberty case got a little bit less attention, but I think it might end up being more important. This was a case that involved the question of whether or not if the government violates your religious beliefs by placing a substantial burden on the exercise of your religion, can you sue the government official who did that for money damages?
You know, if I could interrupt for a second.
Yeah, of course.
What you're saying, I agree with, but I want to scale it down just a little bit for people that may not understand this, that are listening. It's long-held doctrine that the state, that the federal governments, they have immunity based on being the sovereign. And the only time you can sue them or go after them for money or anything else is when they have created a path for you to do so, when they say you can sue us in this arena. So with that backdrop, I'd like you to continue with what you were saying, but I thought that was something that might make it a little more understandable for folks.
Yeah, absolutely. That comes out of really the early days of American law, when the U.S. government was in many ways presumed to step into the place of the king. In England, at the common law, you couldn't sue the king if the king did something against you. He's the king, right? That's it. The king can do what he wants, and that's, you're stuck with it. So the American government is also presumed at the baseline to be like the king, to have what they call sovereign immunity as the sovereign. But in a number of cases, a number of situations, you know, we're in a democracy, people want to be able to sue their government. They can elect representatives that pass laws that allow that. One of those laws is the civil rights laws. You think of them most of the time coming up in relation to the police. When the police do something that violate your civil rights, you can sue the police and get some money, hopefully, perhaps. So the question here was, does that same concept where you can sue a government official like a police officer who violates your rights, can you do that if a government official violates your religious liberties? And the answer the Supreme Court said unanimously again was yes. This is a case brought by three Muslim men. So you might think that some of the more conservative justices on the Supreme Court might be a little antagonistic against them. Not the case. But these were three Muslim men who claimed that the FBI had demanded they become informants. And when they refused to become informants, the FBI placed them on the no-fly list, which means they can't fly on a commercial airliner. And that's obviously a very big limitation on your ability to get yourself around the country or around the world. And these folks sued and they said, hey, look, you're putting a substantial burden on our ability to be Muslims by saying if we want to be Muslims and continue to live our lives as Muslims, we need to become your informants. And if not, you're going to punish us. So the court, in a decision by Justice Thomas, probably the most conservative member of the Supreme Court, said unanimously, you can sue government agents for money who substantially burden your religious rights. And I think that the effect of this really could be monumental, because government actors now kind of have to stop and really think, much like the way the police are supposed to, about whether or not what they're doing might be violating your religious rights. And if they don't do that, or they're wrong about whether what they're doing violates your religious rights, they could be sued for money damages. So you can really imagine the chilling effect that might have on government regulations or government enforcements of regulations that might affect your religious liberties, sort of like the last case we discussed, whether or not those government officials who broke their contract with the Catholic foster company, could they now perhaps be sued for money damages? Maybe. So it'll be very interesting to see how this case kind of comes out and how this law kind of develops over time.
And let me just follow up with a question. A few shows ago, we were talking about the conduct of police, and we spent a great deal of time talking about qualified immunity. So if any of these officials violate someone's religious rights, the doctrine of qualified immunity, correct me if I'm wrong, could also be a defense. These cases for religious rights are all over the place. It's clear as mud, some would say. And so if they inadvertently do violate a right, it's not de facto they have to cut a check. This doctrine would still be a defense, correct?
Probably. It hasn't been litigated yet. I mean, this is a brand new case. These cases haven't made their way up. There are a lot of criticisms of qualified immunity and that doctrine, which doesn't come out of the Constitution or really the statutes. It's something that the court kind of invented itself and is something that has been very much criticized in the post-George Floyd era. And in fact, we had a number of cases this term that involved qualified immunity issues. And Anne can probably probably talk about those. But it will be interesting to see, Josh, whether or and how the law develops. I think you're probably right. I think that especially because the law is so unclear about these kinds of issues involving religion and when the state and your religious rights kind of conflict, that the courts are probably going to be pretty deferential to government officials, except in situations where it's very clear that what the government official is doing is wrong. And here, where the FBI is saying, look, if you don't inform for us, we're going to put you on, we're going to punish you for that. That seemed to be a potentially a very clear situation. We'll see what happens with this case and with other ones, though.
You know, before we run out of time, I did want to touch on one thing. And I know you've been a scholar of some of these cases that are coming down that really look to immunity as it relates to police behavior and how that seems to be shifting in the era post George Floyd. Would you like to talk about that for a bit?
Absolutely. I'm happy to talk about, there are sort of two cases in particular we wanted to talk about. You know, and this is one of the things I think can be really frustrating for people when they're grappling with this area of the law, is that you can see something that seems like particularly egregious behavior by law enforcement, and yet there is no remedy because the court says, look, it's not clearly established. The cases don't clearly say that you can't do X or Y, a particularly bad thing. But I do think that post sort of George Floyd, we have seen some willingness to reconsider, you know, just how much bad behavior qualified immunity is willing to excuse. And so two of those cases the Supreme Court dealt with, one dealt with on full briefing, the other, interestingly, it reversed just on the cert petition and the papers associated with that. So the first is Taylor versus Rioja, and we had talked about that, I think, briefly the last time we were on. And there they said, look, you know, you can't say that it's, you know, not clearly established that correctional officers can't leave an inmate for 6 days naked in a cell that's covered with poop and raw sewage. You just can't do it. You know, and that you can't say that that's not clearly established. In a more recent case in Lombardo versus City of St. Louis, this was a case where an individual was arrested. He's, you know, was trying to hurt himself. The officers went in and restrained him. And then, much like George Floyd, had him on his stomach, you know, with restraints on, and were putting pressure on him, and he ultimately suffocated to death. And they summarily reversed a decision finding that behavior was covered by qualified immunity and said, look, you know, did they incorrectly think that use of a prone restraint is per se, you know, protected so long as an individual appears to be resisting? You know, we don't think that that's the right rule. So go back, think about it again. And it's an interesting example of one of those cases from what we sometimes call the shadow docket, right? Cases that never make it to full briefing and argument, but where the court sort of rules based on what they see. And it's an interesting one because, you know, I think there was an expectation with the makeup of the court that you might not see summary reversals in favor of, or in this case, you know, saying that there might actually be relief for an individual in this position. But that wasn't the only sort of interesting case when it comes to criminal defendants' rights. So taking the case of Coniglia versus Strom, that was a 9-0 decision in favor of a criminal defendant. Or not a criminal defendant, but dealing with a Fourth Amendment issue. And there's this concept called the community caretaking exception that came out in a case versus Katie versus Dombrowski, where they said, look, it doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment if you do a warrantless search of a car that's been pulled over for an unsecured gun. If it's been impounded, that's okay, because police carry out all sorts of what the court called community caretaking functions, responding to disabled vehicles, you know, responding to accidents, and that's okay. But over time, that community caretaking exception has been really expanded. And so in this case, what happened was Mr. Coniglia had an argument with his wife. He put a gun on the table and asked her to just take it and shoot him and, as he put it, get it over with. She left, spent the night elsewhere, and then when she couldn't reach him the next day, she asked the police to do a welfare check. And so the officers met him on the porch, and he agreed to go to the hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. But he said, look, but I'll do it on the condition that you guys don't take my guns. And after he left, they went into the house and took the guns. And this is what we referred to
without earlier, a warrant, importantly.
Without a warrant, yes. And this is where we talked about, you know, the house gets particular protection under the Fourth Amendment, and particularly the conservatives have been very concerned with that. So while we're not advising anybody to commit a crime, you know, if you are going to commit a crime, your house is probably the best place to do it. Because the court said, look, here, you know, you can't use the community caretaking exception to justify a warrantless entry in these circumstances. There's a real difference between what we upheld in Katie versus Dombrowski, where we're talking about a car, as opposed to a home. And, you know, just because there's some sort of interest behind this doesn't mean you have an open-ended license to perform community caretaking functions anywhere and everywhere.
Yeah, you know, I think that the cases that Anne just mentioned probably indicate that the court is at least thinking in the post-George Floyd era a little bit more skeptically about qualified immunity and immunity to police and the rights that individuals have against the police. You know, I know we've got a relatively limited amount of time ahead, you know, before the end of this hour. There are so many other cases we could have discussed, but we do want to make sure that we talk about some of the cases that are coming up for next term. Because this term, even though we have all these interesting cases, this is one where the court was actually probably taking things a little bit easy. The year that a new justice comes on, the Supreme Court tends to take a little bit less controversial of a docket, let people get settled, especially since this year, you know, they didn't know if they're going to be dealing with major election cases, major Trump cases. They just didn't know what was going to be happening when they were taking on these cases. So we want to talk about some of the cases next term, which are probably going to be really, really intense. One big one, it's called Dobbs against Jackson, Missouri Women's Health Organization. This is basically a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood against Casey on abortion and whether or not a state can prevent abortion at 6 weeks, generally before many women even know that they're pregnant. There's another case called New York Rifle and Pistol against Corlett, which is the first Second Amendment case the Supreme Court is going to be dealing with since it determined in 2010 or so that you have a constitutional right to own and keep a handgun in your home. There's a case involving whether the Boston Marathon bomber is going to get the death penalty or not, whether he was given the death penalty, whether there was error in that. So the Boston Marathon bomber is going to come up. There's a case that's going to raise a question that's come up in recent years about whether or not when a governor changes in a state and therefore doesn't want to bring a certain lawsuit defending a state law, for example, like in California, we had, when the government refused to defend Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriage, whether the state attorney general has a right to step in and defend the law. Because that's now coming up more and more often. There's a case involving the Guantanamo Bay and CIA black sites from the War on Terror. There's a case involving whether a public body can censure its members for their speech, which is very relevant to San Francisco, where the city school board recently censured one of its members for saying things on Twitter that were against Asian Americans, or whether that violates the First Amendment. So next term is going to be a real major term, I think. And then there are also cases and, you know, where the court said they weren't going to take up cases for next term. And that's also, I think, pretty important and pretty interesting. There was a case involving the draft and whether or not the law, which still only requires men to register for the draft, probably one of the last areas of federal law that is explicitly sexist, for lack of a better word, or gendered, whether that is still lawful or constitutional. The court didn't take up that case. There was a case about whether or not states can be required to allow transgender youths to use the bathroom of the gender that they identify with, or whether states can prohibit that. The lower courts had said that states cannot interfere with the rights of transgender individuals to use the bathroom of their identity. And the Supreme Court did not take up that case, potentially to overturn it.
And I think, you know, one of the interesting things will be who's deciding this. I think that one of the questions on everyone's mind is not just what cases are going to get decided next term, but which justices are going to be there to decide them. I think there's been a lot of discussion about whether Justice Breyer might retire, and if so, who would be nominated and who would actually be confirmed to replace him.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on Justice Breyer right now to retire because Democrats have a very slim one-vote majority in the Senate. If they lose that majority, for whatever reason, senator loses a re-election, gets run over by a bus, whatever, and there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, the Republicans in the Senate are not going to let the Democrats basically appoint anybody. Mitch McConnell has kind of made clear from the past, they're, you know, in the nomination of Merrick Garland, they're just going to keep that seat open until they're next in a position of power where they can appoint whoever they want. And there's a lot of criticism kind of still being levied against Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg for not retiring in the early years of the Obama administration when the Democrats controlled the Senate and President Obama could have put someone much younger in her place. As a result, she passed away when the Democrats did not have control, the Republicans had control, and her seat was filled with a very conservative individual, Amy Coney Barrett. So there's a lot of pressure on Justice Breyer, but he really has not given any indication that he is thinking about retiring. He's kind of been played it close to the vest, at least so far. Tomorrow is probably going to be the last day of the term. He may make an announcement after that. We'll find out. But, there has been no kind of leaking that he is seriously considering retiring. And in fact, there was a leak the other day from one of his friends that he's at the top of his game, which may be an indicator that he really doesn't want to go anywhere and plans to be around for the next 10 years. We'll find out.
If you look at the number of cases, you know, they've diminished. There was a famous article called 100 cases a term, you know, several decades ago. Now they average somewhere around 50. And I think this term is at a record low. So he may just feel like the court has slowed down and it's sort of a gentle pace that he can continue to maintain.
We shall see. Perhaps when we're back here in October to talk about the new term.
I think you'll be back before that, but I don't think we're going to have any new revelations in the next week. But I'd like to thank you both for coming back once again. I'd like to make this a regular feature where we take up at the beginning of the term those cases which the Supreme Court has agreed to take up and give a sense of what's to come. And at the end of the term, as we are tonight, discussing what's happened over the last year, last Supreme Court term, and exactly where that leaves us.
Ann and I are happy to do it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having us.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We've been looking over the just completed term of the United States Supreme Court, or actually just about to be completed, because we do still have tomorrow at which the Supreme Court will be handing down decisions. With us tonight from King & Spalding, Certified Appellate Law Specialist Ann Voigt, and Ben Fuhrer, Chairman of the California Appellate Law Group. Our show tonight has been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, where we will continue the discussion, take a look at some of the cases the United States Supreme Court declined to hear, and we will discuss today's decision on the Bill Cosby cases. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guests, Ben Fuhrer and Ann Voigt. And especially our thanks to all of you for joining us. For Josh Borger and at the controls, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And thank you so much for listening and supporting Your Legal Rights.